Case number 196340, Jason Raglin versus BM2 Freight Services, Inc. Argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Stephen Simon, you may proceed for the appellant.
Thank you. May it please the court, good morning, your honors. We do reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. And let me say, as a lawyer in downtown Cincinnati with my block, my office just a block from this courthouse, I certainly wish we all could be together this morning and look forward to the day when we will be together in a courtroom. I hope my connection holds and we are able to conduct this oral argument. This is a discrimination case under USERRA. As this court held in Bobo versus UPS, the law was enacted to prohibit discrimination against individuals because of their military service. My client, Jason Raglin, proudly served in the U.S. Marine Corps for 5 years. He was also deployed in Iraq for 3 years, which, of course, was a combat deployment. The sole issue on appeal, Your Honors, is the district court's grant of summary judgment of Mr. Raglin's claim of discrimination under USERRA. We believe if this decision stands, it could significantly undermine the important rights of veterans, rights under this law in future cases. So before highlighting those areas, Your Honors, where we believe the district court went awry, we want to very quickly review the core facts and emphasize that this was a very simple and straightforward case of discrimination and summary judgment should have been denied.
Why was this? We're pretty familiar with the facts, I think. But why was this? Why is this termination tied to his veteran status? Obviously, we all appreciate his service, and the law serves an important purpose to protect veterans. Why was this specific termination tied to his service as opposed to performance issues and some conflicts he had with management?
Right. Thank you, Your Honor. And let me answer that question broadly, and I'll try to focus in on your inquiry there, which is that, like any discrimination case or most discrimination cases, it's proven through circumstantial evidence. And that's established under USERRA that plaintiffs may do that. And once they establish that prima facie case, it's the employer who actually has the affirmative duty to come forward.
Okay, I'm good. I got the legal standard. I'm good with that. So I'm that legal standard.
All right. What I'm trying to say is what you have here, Your Honor, is you have a case where you had a very high performing freight broker who is one of the top earners in the company. He is immediately fired after they learn about this single interaction with his supervisor, where he doesn't like the sales list he's given. He crumples up the piece of paper. He uses some profanity and he throws it in there. Now, you have to understand this office is not like a quiet law firm. This is where brokers are yelling on the phone. There is profanity. And his peer, Your Honor, who has the same job, same title, same level of standard, doesn't have this kind of interaction with the supervisor. He actually screams at the owners behind closed doors, runs out of meetings, and he's not fired for that. So that raises a question that we think with how the fact finder will look at it. Well, why would they immediately fire Mr. Raglin for this when they didn't do anything for Mr. Milosh when he did that? And not only that, they paint this picture of a pattern of attitude.
What ties that to his service, to his veteran status?
Right. And I understand, Your Honor, trust me, I'm not trying to get around the question. I think it needs a full answer that you have somebody who was told he was a wonderful leader in the company and he was honored for his professionalism just 3 weeks before. So that cast doubt on what happened. But why would an employer fire a veteran, veterans who we honor in this country? We have two national holidays, regularly at ball games, they're honored. Why would this employer who hired him only 4 years ago do it?
Can you please just answer? So what was the reason?
And the reason is, Your Honor, is because they bought into the stereotype about combat veterans who suffer from PTSD. It is in the record.
So PTSD is a disability potentially, but you've dropped your disability claim.
Correct, Your Honor. But again, this is what concerns me about the district court decision. If I may, Your Honor, if this was just another protective discrimination case, say it was an African-American who was fired immediately after having this interaction with the supervisor, but white employees could do this and not get fired, it's an obvious case. So the veterans case under USERRA should not be held to a higher standard that we have to somehow completely understand the thinking of this owner. But again, they believed they're not only his supervisor, but the HR manager is asking him about, do you have PTSD? This is only a company with about 30 employees.
I got that. That's really what I was zeroing in on, because I thought that's maybe what you'd get to eventually. So PTSD is a disability, and I would think that under the right case, you could prove an ADA claim by saying you have PTSD. But PTSD is experienced by veterans, certainly, but experienced by lots of people in lots of different circumstances. So that, to me, doesn't make this a, I mean, all what you have is a USURA claim. You don't have an ADA claim. And so it's by implication that he was fired because he had PTSD. So that must mean it was because he was a veteran.
That just isn't our case. And I understand we have the disability claim, which we brought. It was dismissed. We're not appealing. We're trying to understand, why would this employer fire this guy immediately? That's the riddle here. Well, we say the evidence shows that multiple employees, including the HR manager and his supervisor, think that because he fought in a war and saw people get killed, that he's got PTSD. And we know that is a stereotype about military veterans, that they all have PTSD and that they could snap. They fire him immediately. They don't let him come back in the office. They don't let him come back for his personal belongings. And again, Your Honor, the core part isn't just, well, these people made some comments. This is a discrimination case where it's made circumstantially. Under USERRA, veterans don't have to prove something beyond that. In fact, the standard arguably is lower under USERRA than Title VII. The employer actually has the burden to come forward and disprove that they would have fired him for some other reason.
So, counsel, you're saying that the claim here is that they discriminated against him because they assumed, based on behavior that other people engaged in, that he had PTSD and he was going to snap. And so the type of behavior that is pretty commonplace in that environment was interpreted as being a signal that there was violence to come.
Right.
Only because he was a vet.
That's correct, Your Honor. And that sort of interpretation of his, call it confrontation with supervisor, you can see how his supervisor reacted the next day. Now, at his deposition, he said he couldn't remember why he confronted Mr. Ragland the next day. But it sure looks like he had a very visceral reaction to what had happened, where he tells him at his desk, stand up, look at me in the eye like a man. There was something about this confrontation that was then reported to management, the owners, where they viewed it as there's some sort of violence that's going to happen. Again, I would analogize it to a more common situation, say a race discrimination case. African-American employee has that kind of interaction with supervisor, immediately fired. But white employees are allowed to raise their voice and actively towards supervisor. To Judge Riedler's comment of inquiry, and I promise I was not trying to evade the court question, but to me, this is the main issue in this case. USERRA is not held to a higher standard. I don't have to prove, say in a race discrimination case, there's not pretext plus. I don't have to show that they use racial slurs or they've had some specific belief that African Americans were violent. If you have a plaintiff in a race case who that happens to, is the facts I describe it, that's the easiest summary judgment denial there could be. So why is there this deeper inquiry into USERRA simply because it seems strange to us why someone would fire a combat veteran? That is purely.
I don't disagree with you. Go ahead, Judge Clay.
You know, the allegation of PTSD is one thing, but the allegation that that the employer is apprehensive that it's going to lead to violence is something else again. Where in the record is there any indication that the employer or the employees were afraid of or anticipating some violent behavior from your client?
No, Your Honor, there's not other evidence of them accusing him of breaking on violence. We're not depending on that. I'm just underlining the fact that there is nothing in USERRA that says that the plaintiff has to prove what was the specific mindset of why an employer would dare to discriminate under this law. We simply, this court has laid out in Bobo the analysis, and Judge Riedler cut me off. I know that you're aware of it, but disparate treatment is specifically recognized by this court in USERRA cases, because of course, what a fundamental way to prove discrimination. And here you have that Mr. Ragland was told that he was, this is from Mr. Matthew Mason's deposition, page 32. He was told, why were you fired? That he disrespected the VP of sales despite prior warnings after similar incidents. Well, the fact is there were no prior warnings. It's undisputed in the record that this employee had never been warned. There's nothing in his file whatsoever. Were there similar incidents? There were not. What's very disturbing about this case is that the district court quoted or cited this incident where Mr. Ragland allegedly told one of the owners, I question your integrity. It was allegedly a heated meeting that the other owner had to come into and intervene. When asked at his deposition, Mr. Ragland said, that didn't happen, totally fabricated. That did not happen. What happened instead was there had been a conversation about a dispute over whose customers was who. But under the summary judgment standard this court knows so well, there is no, it is disputed that that happened, yet it still found its way in the court's opinion. And in BM2's appeal brief, they cite that decision without any reference to the fact that Mr. Ragland said it's totally fabricated.
What about this whole thing about that they were trying to change the culture there, that they had consultants and, you know, we're just trying to change it to a more positive atmosphere at the time.
Yeah, we don't question that. So why do you fire Mr. Ragland for that incident, but you don't even discipline Mr. Malosh for screaming at owners? They don't even fire Mr. Malosh after there's complaints by other employees that he made another employee cry.
Well, when was this?
What's that?
When did those things happen?
The disciplines occur after the termination with a Mr. Malosh that I just described. But the screaming at the owners happens before Mr. Ragland's termination. There's also a confrontation with the owner, with Mr. Malosh, where he says, I'm being screwed by the sales commission structure. Well, why is that not worthy of discipline, but Mr. Ragland's comment is? I just want to emphasize that their reason given is just plain false. There weren't prior warnings after similar incidents. They rely on these emails that were sent to show that, I see an amount of time. Can I briefly conclude?
Sure, go ahead.
I just want to say with these emails, there's no warnings in these emails. And when I asked Mr. Abal about these emails, he admitted there was no warning. One of them he said might be, you know, he didn't even know what to call it. But it's not a similar incident. There's no insubordination. There's no anything in these earlier incidents.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
We'll hear from opposing counsel.
Good morning. May it please the court. I believe it's clear from counsel's presentation this morning and the court's questions that the court obviously is well aware of USERRA. Each of your honors has handled cases under USERRA, and your questions are pointed to direct Mr. Simon to where is the evidence that Mr. Ragland's termination resulted because he is a veteran, because he proudly served as a Marine. As your honor, as Judge Raylor mentioned, and as BM2 noted in its brief and throughout this case, Mr. Ragland's service is highly respected. As Kevin Ball, the company's president.
But counsel, there are a lot of biases that we have that could be, they're not right on the surface. So yes, it was respected. They thought it would be valuable, but he's making an argument that he was treated differently. And when he blew up or became upset, that immediately the defendants went into this, oh my God, he's a vet, he's got PTSD, and we're in danger frame of mind, and got rid of him. So why isn't there a question of fact whether that's the case?
Your Honor, I appreciate the question, but there is not a shred of evidence to support that, quite frankly, offensive implication or accusation by Mr. Ragland. Not one piece of evidence, not one comment, not one hint. To the extent anyone ever asked him that Mr. Ragland, whether he had PTSD, which I believe, quite frankly, is a red herring, having abandoned the ADA claim. But to the extent anyone ever asked him about his service and whether he had PTSD, Mr. Ragland affirmed under oath that he always denied it. He never had PTSD. He never told anyone he had PTSD. And none of the three owners who, it's uncontested, they are the decision makers in this case. None of the three owners ever talked to Mr. Ragland about him having PTSD, asked him about having PTSD. And there's no evidence that any employee ever had similar conversations with the owners. So again, getting to the termination, Mr. Ragland is, again, it's uncontested in the record from the deposition testimony of the three owners. He was not terminated because of the confrontation on May 16th. That, you know, the events of May 16 and 17, as all three owners testified, were simply icing on the cake, the proverbial straw that broke the camel's back. The confrontation that Mr. Simon mentioned happened on May 16th. He was not terminated immediately after. It was the next day on May 17th when his supervisor, who was not the decision maker, had no involvement in his termination, went to Mr. Ragland's desk and had that confrontation. The evidence in the record is that Mr. Ragland was extremely calm. He handled himself extremely professionally. He did not yell. He stood up and answered Mr. Cleaver's questions. There was no animosity demonstrated by Mr. Ragland at all during that so-called confrontation. What happened thereafter is that he went into Matt Mason's office, one of the three owners, and complained about the incident and said, you know, I'm not going to be spoken to this way. Essentially, I'm out of here. Mr. Ragland, but all three owners confirmed under oath that he was not terminated because of the events on May 16 and 17. As Judge White, as you asked about the cultural change, the company had been undergoing changes during 2016. They had hired a consultant. They were very concerned about their cultural changes. Things in the market were changing. Numbers were changing from people's, you know, performance, company revenues. They were trying to change the culture within the company. And while they previously, and always respected Mr. Ragland's service, quite frankly, while they previously had recognized his performance from a sales perspective and leadership by making him a team leader, that happened in January of 2016. Things changed thereafter, again, as all three owners testified. February, March, April, May, they had encounters with Mr. Ragland, which they testified about having discussed at their Monday morning ownership meetings regarding his negative attitude, his constant complaints, questioning about the attendance policy or the work hours. He, in their opinion, as the owners and operators of this business, viewed him as, you know, essentially wanting special treatment. Yes, he was a high performer. Congratulations, he got paid accordingly. But he did not then necessarily deserve special treatment. And they specifically, as owners of the company, wanted to abandon that notion. They did not want people who were so-called high performers to be viewed from their colleagues as getting special treatment of some kind. They wanted everyone in the office, I want to say from 8 to 5, but I could be off a little bit there, but the same hours. They didn't want someone going to the gym in the morning or coming in at 9, 9:30, as I believe Mr. Ball testified about Mr. Ragland, and even Mr. Ragland acknowledged on occasion. And while that
did might have been continue, fine, after those discussions, did he continue to come in on his own schedule?
No, I do not believe so, Your Honor. It was just, that was just one in a chain of events where he, you know, complained to ownership about, hey, how they were running their company. He wanted, as he testified, he wanted essentially to be able to run his, you know, what he viewed as his book of business as his separate, you know, company within BM2. So,
and what about Melos? Wasn't he permitted to do that or not?
No, Your Honor, I don't think there's any evidence in the record to that effect. And, you know, to the extent, you know, Mr. Ragland's entire case, I think, hinges on the allegation that Mr. Melos is a comparator under the law with respect to Mr. Ragland. He absolutely is not a valid comparator under the law. Did they have the same position? Yes. That's it. That's all they had. They did not engage in substantially similar conduct under this court's precedent. You know, counsel mentions Mr. Melosh supposedly yelled at meetings. Well, with all due respect, being loud or yelling at a meeting is not verbally, being verbally dismissive or aggressive toward the owners, toward your bosses. I mean, I can go yell in a meeting, but that without the context, without the words that someone says, and there's no evidence that Mr. Melosh ever cursed at his bosses or said anything derogatorily toward them or toward the manner in which they operated their company. So, and as Judge White, as you asked counsel about those other events, the events, as counsel mentioned about the other employees, counsel says they happened after termination. In fact, they happened 17 to 20 months after Mr. Ragland's termination. And as Matthew Mason testified at his deposition, between May of 2016 and more than a year and a half later, the company had changed. The company had altered policies, continuing to alter its culture and change policies. The company was growing. I mean, this was not a company in 2016 where, a la P&G or GE, where they had really stringent, structured evaluation, review, warning processes. The evidence in the record is that they did not follow any type of structure in that regard. And yes, they did not view the emails or complaints about work hours or things of that nature that necessarily rose to the level of needing a warning in any event. That wasn't the issue with Mr. Ragland. It was his general attitude, his negative attitude, the negative impact he was having on the company culture. As the owners testified, I believe it was Kevin Ball, if I'm not mistaken, and it's cited in our brief. I mean, they struggled with this decision. I mean, it's not too often that a company, the size of BM2 is willing to terminate one of their top performers over a quote unquote negative cultural issue. But they knew that their company, again, which they have the right to manage as they deem appropriate, as long as they're not doing something illegal, they knew that their company needed to change. And they decided after careful consultation with an outside consultant that they, quite frankly, they didn't have a choice. If they wanted their company to grow and thrive, they needed to cut someone like Mr. Ragland, who was not a true leader, who did not buy into the company's culture as they deemed appropriate. And again, it wasn't the events of May 16 or 17 that caused them to make that decision. It was just the camel that broke the straw's back. So, bottom line here is based on the evidentiary record before the trial court and before this court, Mr. Ragland has not demonstrated or has not proven his prima facie case under USERRA. The district court reached the correct decision in granting summary judgment on behalf of the employer. Now, the district court notably did not undertake the analysis as to whether the pretext analysis, because it found correctly that Mr. Ragland had not proven his prima facie case. But even if this court were to assume that Mr. Ragland did prove a prima facie case, which he did not, the company has brought forth and presented evidence and proven that it still would have terminated him regardless of some alleged discriminatory reason based on his status as a veteran.
That's basically the same evidence you just recited for the last few minutes. You've been putting a lot of that evidence into the prima facie case basket, which is appropriate, but a lot of that evidence would also go to pretext as well, right?
It does, Your Honor. I mean, these were the reasons that they let him go. None of them are invalid. These are decisions that this company made based on how they deem appropriate to run their company. And if you look at the case law to try to prove or disprove, I should say, that the company's reasons were pretextual, none of the factors identified under the case law apply here. The company, there's no question about any inconsistencies here. There's no question about the disparate treatment between Mr. Melosh and Mr. Ragland. Mr. Ragland takes issue with the district court's reference to the timing But as we note in our brief, there is not a case that we could find anywhere in the country, certainly not within the Sixth Circuit, where that has a similar fact pattern, where someone was discharged from his service in the military and then terminated 12 years later, 4 years after starting with the employer who hired him, quite frankly, based on his service in the military, but then suddenly turned around 4 years later and fired him for their same reason. I mean, there's not a case in the country based on similar fact pattern. So I think the timing was absolutely a relevant consideration for the district court. It was not dispositive, and the district court did not say it is, but it is a factor recognized by this court's precedent. Similarly, the same actor inference was appropriately considered by the district court and should be considered by this court. I mean, there's no question whatsoever, based on the evidentiary record before the court, that these three owners are the decision makers at BM2. These three people hired him, and these three people fired him. No one else played a role in this process. So the same actor inference is a legitimate factor under Wexler. I do not believe that there are other questions of fact that would cause this court to disregard that inference. And based on the record before the court, Mr. Ragland simply has not overcome it.
Whether we agree with the same actor inference or not, we can still find for your client, correct?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, Your Honor. I think you can and should find for my client based on Mr. Ragland's failure to prove his prima facie case and the company's successful demonstration that their reasons for terminating him were not pretextual. And I know I have a little bit more time, but unless the court, any of your honors have questions, I'm already sitting down, but I will continue sitting down.
Thank you very much. And we'll take rebuttal.
Your honors, you need to look very carefully at this record. So much of what we've heard from Mr. McMahon is essentially a closing argument. The standard, of course, is different under summary judgment. Judge White, you had asked about the emails. The email where Mr. Ragland asked about the starting time. Mr. Ball admitted, the owner admitted at page 67 of his deposition, that he did not terminate Mr. Ragland because he disagreed with this policy. He also acknowledged that he knew as many as four or five other employees who complained about that starting time policy. That had nothing to do with the termination. BM2 acknowledged that this alleged period of trouble by Mr. Ragland, bad attitude, was the last 5 months. Mr. Ball even said it might be the last 6 months. So that would push it back to December. In January, he's promoted. He's promoted during this period that they say things falls apart. They say, well, maybe it happened later. He's given an undated note that Mr. Ragland believes is within 3 weeks of his termination from his supervisor, where his supervisor says, you are extremely vital to the success of this company. How in the world can the employer on summary judgment say, you're fired because you've had a bad attitude the last 5 months, when the supervisor says that? This business of discounting Mr. Malosh, what he did, he didn't just yell at the owners in a meeting and walk out. There's sworn testimony that he stormed out, slammed the door, and then left the office. Mr. McMahon would have you believe that a jury couldn't believe that he was being derogatory towards the owners. Isn't that more disrespectful to storm out of a meeting with the owners in front of everybody and slam the door than what Mr. Ragland did? That is for a jury to decide. It is absurd to say that Mr. Ragland is not, or Mr. Malosh is not a comparator. He is a dead-on comparator. Dead-on comparator that this court cannot ignore. And if the district court below, if he was sitting in a jury, it looks like he would have voted against Mr. Ragland. That's not the court's province. It's for the jury to decide these facts. On the law, I say one minute. On the law, I'm very concerned about this focus on the comments about PTSD. That is evidence we present to a jury. They'll find it relevant or not. We absolutely, in a discrimination case, do not have to prove pretext plus. The Supreme Court has made that clear in discrimination cases. There's no way that you serve.
Counsel, did your client ever advise the employer that he was suffering from PTSD?
Your Honor, he didn't. He didn't. He got these question after question. Did you kill people in Iraq? Do you have PTSD? Including the HR manager, who was very disturbed by it. But no, he didn't. He didn't suggest that to the owners. He didn't have that conversation.
Did your client ever receive a diagnosis from a doctor or mental health professional that he was suffering from PTSD?
There's nothing in the record, Your Honor, that through the date of summary judgment that he did, no.
But you're not claiming he did, right?
I'm not claiming that he did, no. I see that I'm out of time, Your Honor. So if you have any other further questions, I'd be glad to answer.
I don't believe so, unless my colleagues indicate otherwise, and I don't see any such indication. So thank you very much. And arguments are concluded. Good arguments on both sides, and the case is submitted.